الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. All praise is due to God, and may God's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad and on all the prophets who have been sent by God to mankind. The purpose of today's presentation is to bring to you something of an understanding of the Arabian culture. I know a number of you have been here for some time working, and you have not had any kind of opportunity to be exposed to any kind of sessions, orientation type sessions, which would give you some kind of a background as to the people and the culture. I mean, what you know of it is basically what you have gained from just basic day-to-day contact. But what happens is that it's very easy for us to misunderstand the practices of people if we don't understand what's behind those practices. You know, why a person does this, why a person does that. If we don't really understand what is the rationale behind it, then we tend to judge it according to our own cultural background. Now, I'm from Canada, and I've been over here for, you know, a number of years. And I know when I first came over here, I was somewhat perplexed at some of the cultural habits and practices of the people here. And it took me a while to get used to it. But because of the fact that I went into a course of study, I studied at the university here, graduate master's in Islamic studies from the universities of the kingdom here. And that gave me the kind of insight which enabled me to understand, you know, something of the culture, the history, and the people, and in that way, it also enabled me to help others. You know, I have I work with the Air Force headquarters in Riyadh, and I go from different bases, one base to another base, at various points in every month, to help in the process of orientation, of giving people a background, you know, English-speaking people a background as to the culture of Arabia, the culture and practices of Arabia. And the purpose of this is really to help you all who are here visiting this country, working in the country, better understand the people, to make your own dealings with them easier. Because when you can understand why a person is doing what they're doing, then it's easier to get along with them. It's easier to let certain things slide, which normally, you know, you would take as offensive, etc. And similarly, it's also a way or an opportunity for the people of this country, you know, through me, to bring to you an understanding of their culture, which to a large degree in the West, you know, or Western-oriented countries have been distorted. You know, a lot of people come, I've sat and talked with many people with no end of misunderstandings, you know, misconceptions about the culture and the people of this region. So the purpose, as I said, was to give you some insight and to give you an opportunity also to share with me, discuss with me your own experiences, things that, you know, don't quite add up for you, things that you'd like to get certain clarity on. This is what I'm here for also. And please don't feel in any way shy about asking anything. You know, whatever I have the information for, I'll give you. If I don't have the information, I'll tell you. First thing, when we talk about Arabian culture, it's important to understand who the Arabs are. One, the Arabs are a Semitic people, fundamentally indigenous to the Arabian Peninsula. This is the basic definition of who the Arabs are. Semitic peoples, indigenous to the Arabian Peninsula. So that, for one, tells us that it is impossible for an Arab to be an anti-Semite. You see, we hear If somebody opposes Israel, he is usually branded in the West as an anti-Semite. If he does, you know, if he's against America supporting Israel, maintaining Israel's existence, he's branded, no matter what his background, he's branded as an anti-Semite. But it is impossible for an Arab to be an anti-Semite because he is a Semite himself. He is from the Semitic people. So that's the first thing I just wanted to clarify, you know, as I'm passing. However, today when we talk about Arabs, it includes all people who speak Arabic as their mother tongue. And this includes Christians. Christians, and there are many Arabs in Egypt, in Palestine, in Jordan, Syria, in Lebanon, who are Christians and Arabs. So, normally people tend to put Arab and Muslim together as one and the same thing. However, in fact, it is not. Actually, this definition of those who speak Arabic, it excludes only one group, and that is the Jews. You also have Jews who speak Arabic in Yemen, in North Africa, in what is now known as Israel, and in other parts of the Arab world, you find Jews whose mother tongue is Arabic. However, they have excluded themselves from the general category of Arabs. It is not the Arabs who decided, listen, Arabs includes everybody but Jews. No, Jews excluded themselves from that general category. And what you find is that many of the Arabic people who you now know in Egypt, in Sudan, in North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, etc., these people did not originally speak Arabic. Their language, they all had indigenous languages in their areas, whether it was Berber in North Africa or, you know, Coptic languages in Egypt and the Sudan. However, when Islam spread to that region, the peoples, in order to be able to communicate with the administration of the areas, began to take up certain Arabic terms. Just as whilst you are here, you know, if you have to go into town or deal with the people here, to some degree you're going to pick up one little word here or there, shukran or something like this, you pick up a few little words here and there. What happens is that in time, those peoples, in taking up words, the words increased into the languages until the languages evolved and turned over into Arabic. Now, Arabia refers to the Arabian Peninsula, which according to the Arabs, they refer to it as Jaziratul Arab, or the island of the Arabs. This is the largest peninsula in the world, approximately 1 million square miles. And for, just to put it in context for Americans, it is about the same size as continental America east of the Mississippi. If you take everything east of the Mississippi, add that all together, that's equivalent in area to the Arabian Peninsula. To understand Arabia, we have to look to some degree at the early history. And the early history is generally divided into two sections. The pre-Islamic period, which is referred to as the period of Jahiliyyah, or the period of ignorance, and the Islamic period, which came in the 6th century, from the 6th century onwards. In the pre-Islamic period, we find that the peoples of Arabia trace their origin to two main ancestors. Those of the south in Yemen, they trace their origin to an individual by the name of Qahtan, who in the Bible is referred to as Joktan. And the northern Arabians trace their ancestry through Adnan. And Adnan and his descendants were mixed with Ishmael, the son of Abraham, who now becomes sort of like the father of the Arabs in general. So again, when you look at who the Jews are, being the descendants of Isaac, What you find is that the Jews and Arabs are actually brothers. They come from the same family tree. Ishmael being the father of the Arabs and Isaac being the father of the Jews. Now, Arabia in ancient times was of importance to the Middle East or the world for two main economic products. The two were products of two trees which grew in South Yemen. Frankincense, which was burned as a fragrance in pagan religious rituals, and myrrh, which was used in cosmetics and embalming the dead. These are the main two products of this region. And it was taken out into the rest of the Middle East, into Europe, into Asia, and this was the particular significant economic significance of this area. And those of us who are from Christian background, who recall the story of Jesus and Jesus' birth, we know about the three wise men who were bringing, they were riding camels, and they were bringing, you know, amongst the gifts they brought was frankincense and myrrh. It was coming from this area. The period of Jahiliyyah was noted for feuds. You had the people of Arabia were in various tribes which would involve themselves in feuds over very simple issues which would last for generations. The center of worship of this area was Mecca, which is to the north of this area, Mecca. And there in Mecca was a structure known in Arabic as the Kaaba. Kaaba literally means cube. And I'm sure you've seen some pictures, whether it's on television or photographs, you know, in magazines or whatever, of Mecca with that black cube where people are bowed down in worship around it. Now, this object is in fact, according to Arabic tradition, a house of worship, the first house of worship, which was built by Prophet Abraham and Ishmael. When Prophet Abraham left his wife Hagar here in Mecca with his and son Ishmael, he came back and the two of them later built what is known as the Kaaba, being the first house of worship. And it was dedicated to the worship of one God, which was the God known in the traditions of Moses and the prophets of Israel. However, in time, idolatry was introduced, and the major tribes of Arabia, they all put their idols around the Kaaba, so the Kaaba itself became the center of idolatry in Arabia. People would make pilgrimage there, but for worship of idols. The idea and the concept of the term Allah, which means one God, it remained amongst the people. However, they worshipped gods as intermediaries, whether they built them with their own hands or whatever. They worshipped them as intermediaries between themselves and the one God. Christianity and Judaism also existed in the Arabian Peninsula. In the area of Najran, which is not too far from here, was a very large Christian community. And in the south, in Yemen, was a very large Jewish community. In the 6th century after the time of Christ, a South Yemenese king by the name of Zu Nuwas accepted or converted to Judaism and ruled that whole area of South Yemen. And in fact, there was an incident which took place between the king, this Zu Nuwas of Yemen, and the Christians of Najran, in that he attempted to forcibly convert them to Judaism. They refused, and a number of them were killed. A pit of fire, according to the tradition, a pit was dug and it was filled with fire, and those people, or Christians of Najran who refused, were thrown into this pit. And this incident is recorded in the Quran, which is known as the Book of Revelations, which Muslims follow. In the 85th chapter, verses 4 to 8, it commemorates or honors those Christians who died for their faith, the martyrs of Najran. Now, from the 6th century onwards, 6th century being the time in which Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him and on all the prophets, was born in Mecca. And at the age of 40, in 612, he began to receive revelation. By the time of his death in 636, Islam had spread all over Arabia. The whole of Arabia had become or had accepted Islam. And what we have to understand is that primarily Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, did not claim that he was bringing a new religion. The religion of Islam that you know of, it means fundamentally submission to the will of God. This is what the Arabic word means, submission. Islam means submission to the will of God. And according to his teaching, it was the same as what was taught by Jesus, by Moses, by Abraham, by Adam. Submission to the will of God. And one who submits to the will of God is called in Arabic a Muslim. In English, normally when we describe a person, you know, in terms of a particular religion or a place, we add a suffix. You know, from Christianity you get Christians. So from Islam you sort of expect Islamians or something like this. However, in Arabic, they put a prefix to indicate that relationship. Just as you know the term jihad, commonly explained to mean a holy war, though in Islam there really is no such thing as a holy war. I mean, this is something we can look at another point. But just for namesake, we say jihad. The person who fights jihad is called a mujahid. Have you heard of the mujahideen in Afghanistan? I'm sure you've heard this term used. So you see that a prefix is put on the word to indicate one who is related to this particular act or place, etc. So this is why the term Islam and Muslim, Islam meaning submission to the will of God, Muslim being one who submits to the will of God. And because of this, Muslims are very particular about being called Mohammedans, you know, which you may find in a number of, especially the older texts, books which are written 20, 30 years ago, Mohammedans, this term being used, they find it very objectionable. Because Mohammedans somehow implies the worship of Muhammad or the taking of Muhammad as some kind of intercessor or intermediary, etc. Where in fact, according to Islamic teachings, he is not an intercessor. No one worships him. He was only looked at as a messenger of God who brought a message which was the same message of previous prophets. So that term is rejected. Similarly, Mohammedanism is not acceptable. It is Islam and Muslim. Now the term Saudi Arabia, or officially the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it takes its name after King Abdulaziz Al Saud, who established the kingdom in 1932. His family name being Saud, it became known as Saudi Arabia. The flag that you see, the green flag, has certain, you see, squiggly white lines on it, which in fact is Arabic calligraphy, expressing the declaration of faith of Muslims. La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah, which means there is no God but Allah, the one God, and Muhammad is a messenger of Allah. What is underneath it is the sword. I know when you see the sword, you think the sword is what they used to chop off the heads every Friday, right? But again, the sword is not specifically, you know, dealing with that issue, although it is a part of it all. The sword represents the force which must be behind the faith for that faith to become real, to become established as a force in a land. So it's a force which supports the faith, which also is the force of justice, to establish the justice which the faith calls to. Of course, you realize that all the neighboring countries are all what they call Arab nations, whether it's to the north, you have Iraq and Jordan. To the east, you have the countries of Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and to the west, across the waters, you find Sudan, Egypt, etc. Geographically, the country is usually divided up into five major regions. The eastern coastline is called the Hijaz, and this area called Asir. They're all sort of connected, and they're all east of a chain of mountains which are called Hijaz mountains. And Hijaz itself means a border. So the mountains form a natural border between East Arabia and the west of Arabia. Najd, the area where the capital of Arabia is, Riyadh, is called Najd because Najd actually means a plateau. And if any of you ever drive to Najd, if you have any cars to drive there, I know it's very hot and I'm sure you probably wouldn't want to give up the weather here for Riyadh, but if you ever get there, you find that you have to go up a very steep embankment to get up there, and the whole of Riyadh is on a plateau, which is referred to as the Najd. The eastern region, called the Mantaqa Sharqiyya, is the area where most of the oil is being exploited now. The northern region, called Mantaqa Shamaliyya, is the area where you find most of the nomads, people who still live on the desert without any settled homes. And the other major area, the two great deserts, to the north, called Nufud, and Nufud means sand dunes, and to the south, called the Rub' al-Khali, which means the empty quarter. And this area, Rub' al-Khali, which they have found a number of oil deposits, this area has the largest concentration of sand of any deserts in the world. And the sand dunes there reach over 1,000 feet high. Between the two, there's an area called Dahna of deserts, which join, a strip of deserts which join the north region to the south. Now, in terms of the modern history of Arabia, Saudi Arabia, with the rise of Islam in the 7th century, and Islam spread from Arabia across North Africa, down into the Sudan, right across into Spain, southern France, Sicily, southern Italy, up north into Lebanon, what used to be known as Asia Minor, which is now Turkey, and across into southern Russia, into China, we find the Muslim world was ruled at first from Medina, which is in that area of Hijaz. We had two major cities there, Mecca and Medina, Mecca being the place where the Prophet was born. But in the course of calling to his teachings, his message, he was driven out from there and moved north to the city known as Medina, where he established himself and Islam spread, and from there it spread and over to the rest of Arabia. He was also buried there. This city was the center or capital of the Islamic State or Empire in the early stages. Following that, it shifted to Damascus, which is now in Syria, then on to Baghdad, now in Iraq. And you find that this Muslim empire, which spread all the way over to the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, this Muslim empire were ruled by a variety of different people. They were not all Arabs. You find Syrians, you find Mesopotamians, you find Egyptians, Persians, and Turks ruled this empire over this period of time. Now, during the medieval to modern times, we find that the area of Hijaz and the area of Al-Hasa, or the eastern region, was under Ottoman rule as well as under Egyptian rule. And in the 18th century, a religious reformer by the name of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who was educated outside of the country, came back in and recognized that a lot of distortions had taken place in the practice of the religion, started to call people back to practicing Islam in the pure form. He may be identified, you know, in Western texts as being a fundamentalist of his time. I mean, in fact, there is no such thing as fundamentalism in Islam. It is just practicing, you know, Islam. It's either you're practicing Islam or you're not practicing Islam. And he called the people back to this practice. He was rejected by the people of his own town.